This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with verses 218 to 219. From the chapter Al-Baqarah from the Holy Quran, recited by Ali Parhizgar.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Innalladhina amanu walladhina hajaru wajahadu fi sabilillah. إن الذين آمنوا والذين هاجروا وجاهدوا في سبيل الله أولئك يرجون رحمة الله أُولَٰئِكَ يَرْجُونَ رَحْمَةَ اللَّهِ وَاللَّهُ غَفُورٌ رَحِيمٌ يَسْأَلُونَكَ عَنِ الْخَمْرِ وَالْمَيْسِرِ قُلْ فِيهِمَا كبير ومنافع للناس قل فيهما إثم كبير ومنافع للناس وإثمهما أكبر من نفعهما ويسألونك ماذا ينفقون قل العفو وكذلك يبين الله لكم الآيات لعلكم تتفكرون ويسألونك ماذا ينفقون قل العفو كذلك يبين الله لكم الآيات الْآيَاتِ لَعَلَّكُمْ تَتَفَكَّرُونَ.
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Surely, those who believed and those who fled their home and strove hard in the way of Allah, these hope for the mercy of Allah, and Allah is forgiving, merciful. They ask you about intoxicants and games of chance. Say, in both of them, there is a great sin and means of profit for men. And their sin is greater than their profit. And they ask you as to what they should spend. Say, what you can spare. Thus does Allah make clear to you the communications that you may ponder.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines: Israel's indiscriminate strikes kill 84 more civilians across the Gaza Strip. Iran strongly condemns Israel's inhumane crimes against medical staff and patients at Gaza's Al-Shifa Hospital. And rallies are held in various Iranian cities and other countries to condemn Israel's atrocities in Gaza and the West's support for the regime. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisum Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. Palestinians are experiencing an endless spiral of death and destruction as the Israeli genocidal war on Gaza enters its 171st day. Medical sources say that Israeli forces have committed 8 massacres in Gaza over the past 24 hours, killing 84 civilians and injuring scores of others. At least 10 people were killed in the Israeli bombing of Rafah. One Palestinian was killed in Gaza City. Israeli warplanes also hit the Al-Shati refugee camp in northern Gaza, leaving a number of Palestinians dead and injured. Meanwhile, the regime forces have besieged 2 more hospitals apart from Al-Shifa and blocking food and medical aid into Gaza. The UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees says Israel has informed that it would no longer allow UNRWA food convoys into northern Gaza. UNRWA has called the blockade outrageous. The Israeli genocide in Gaza has claimed more than 32,200 lives, mostly women and children. Our correspondent Moti Abu Musabe says the Israeli forces are stepping up their attacks on the Gaza Strip, leaving behind more civilian casualties.
Let me begin with the latest statement of Gaza's health ministry in terms of the Israeli crimes committed against the Palestinian people and the number of the Palestinian casualties across all areas of Gaza Strip. As over the last 24 hours, the Israeli occupation forces committed at least 8 appalling massacres against the Palestinian residents in all areas of Gaza Strip, claiming the lives of at least 82 Palestinian civilians and injuring some 110 others. These numbers actually are still so with the continuous and incessant Israeli attacks and airstrikes that are still hitting several areas of Gaza Strip. From Rafah City, as you know, that the Israeli occupation forces intensified their attacks over the Palestinian residential buildings there. From dawn hours so far, we are talking about roughly 21 Palestinian civilians have been killed over those attacks, as several residential buildings were hammered by the Israeli warplanes. These airstrikes are still continued so far, as the eastern part of the city were subjected to heavy attacks and heavy bombardments of the Israeli airstrikes. When it comes to Khan Yunis city, the Israeli occupation forces conducted a ground offensive against the Nasser Medical Complex and Al-Amal Hospital tunnel located in the western part of the city amid heavy gunfire and continuous airstrikes and continuous shelling of the Israeli tanks reaching those areas. Needless to mention that those areas were subjected to a brutal ground offensive that targeted them over the last couple of months, as the vast majority of those buildings and those houses were completely or partially destroyed over the chronic Israeli attacks and incursions that reached that area.
Israeli forces have been raping and executing women during their raid on Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City. That is according to a Palestinian woman who has been trapped in a building near the hospital witnessing the tragedy unfolding there. Jamila Al-Hisi says Palestinian women were also starved, tortured, and kidnapped. In other horrific details, she added that the Israeli forces pulled dead bodies from under the rubble to unleash their dogs on them. Al-Hisi had been trapped in a building near Al-Shifa Hospital for 6 days before being forced out by the Israeli forces. She said troops also torched a building where Palestinian civilians were taking shelter, burning to death the entire families inside. Israel launched a raid and a siege on Al-Shifa Hospital a week ago, killing at least 170 people and abducting hundreds more. The hospital was Gaza's biggest medical facility before the Israeli onslaught on the besieged strip. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman has condemned Israel's horrific, inhumane crimes at Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City. Nasser Kanani said those atrocities have added to Israel's shameful acts and its dark list of crimes. He expressed sadness over the killing of scores of people over the past days in Israel's raid on the hospital and its restrictions on basic medical supplies. He also referred to reports indicating that Palestinian women were raped and tortured during the Israeli raid on Al-Shifa. Kanani urged an international probe into the volume of Israel's war crimes at the medical facility. He recalled the responsibilities of the international community and Islamic State with regard to Palestinian lives in war-ridden Gaza. Al-Shifa Hospital is not the only health facility under Israeli siege. According to the Palestinian Red Crescent, Israeli forces have laid siege on two more hospitals in the southern city of Khan Yunis. And UN Chief Antonio Guterres has renewed calls for a ceasefire in Gaza, saying that the besieged Palestinian territory needs a flood of aid.
Looking at Gaza, it almost appears that the four horsemen of war, famine, conquest and death are galloping across it. And that is why the time for an immediate humanitarian ceasefire is now, and in the Ramadan spirit of compassion, I also urge the immediate and unconditional release of hostages. The suffering must end. Palestinians in Gaza desperately need what has been promised, a flood of aid.
Guterres was speaking following talks with Egypt's president and the foreign minister in Cairo. The UN chief said the only effective way to ramp up aid delivery to Gaza is by road. He also called for Israel's firm commitment to allow aid to reach all parts of the besieged territory. Guterres is visiting Egypt and Jordan as part of an annual Ramadan solidarity tour to Muslim countries. On Sunday, he toured the Rafah crossing between Gaza and Egypt. The crossing is the only access point where aid trucks can enter Gaza, but they are stuck on Egypt's side of the border as Israel continues to block aid from entering Gaza, where people are starving. Palestinians in the occupied West Bank are also suffering from growing Israeli violence. In the latest such acts, Israeli forces abducted over a dozen Palestinians across the West Bank, while scores of settlers raided the Al-Aqsa compound in occupied Al-Quds. Our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kendall, joined us earlier with more details.
The Israeli forces storm Palestinian areas on a daily basis. This morning, the Israelis had arrested at least 15 Palestinians from across the occupied West Bank. The majority of those Palestinians were detained in Jenin and as well as Al-Khalil in the village of Al-Liban Al-Gharbi, North Ramallah. And the majority of those had been arrested by the Israeli forces were former prisoners. Even if those Palestinian prisoners and former prisoners finished their sentences and they were released several years ago, however, we have been noticing that the Israeli forces were immediately storming the houses of ex-Palestinian prisoners and arresting them, as well as family members of Palestinian prisoners who are still incarcerated in Israeli jails. As you have mentioned, the Israeli settlers, had stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex today. Over 100 Israeli settlers stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex as well as they were celebrating one of their Jewish holidays known as Purim, or in the as the Jews know them as the Sukkot feast. Of course, we are speaking about over 100 Israeli settlers protected and supported by the Israeli forces. At the same time, the Palestinian Muslims are not allowed to enter Al-Quds or Al-Aqsa. West Bank residents are completely denied access to Al-Aqsa or entering Al-Quds only on Fridays, with women above the age of 50 and men above the age of 55 and after getting Israeli issued permits.
Moving on, Lebanon's resistance movement Hezbollah has been engaged with fighting with the Israeli regime on Lebanon's southern border since the onset of the war on the Gaza Strip in early October. Hezbollah says it aims to support Palestinian resistance fighters battling Israeli forces in Gaza. In the latest development, Hezbollah has launched several rockets at Israeli positions in the occupied Golan Heights. Our correspondent Maryam Saleh joined us earlier from Beirut to give us more details.
The Israelis go beyond the scope of the rules of engagement or the limited geographic scope which Hezbollah has drawn from the beginning of the confrontation. We notice that Hezbollah directly retaliates by using Katyusha rockets, by using longer range rockets, or issues that or a bigger number of rockets, if you may say, on areas that are further away from the border with Lebanon. And so we notice how there were 60 rockets that reached the settlement of Yawaf, and specifically the barracks in the Golan Heights. And here in Keilah specifically, Hezbollah mentioned in their statements that that rocket attack specifically coincided with a training session and exercise for the elite forces, the Golani elite forces of the Israelis. And they also mentioned in the statement that they had just returned from Gaza and therefore they were conducting an exercise. And so that in itself is a clear message from Hezbollah to the Israelis that Hezbollah does have the intel they need in order to know the movement of the Israelis. They are able to know which unit came back from Gaza, what exactly they were doing in that area. And so Hezbollah also seemed to mention that perhaps there could be inflicted heavy losses upon that force specifically, but also that tells the Israelis that in any future confrontation, the Israelis have always thought that they are superior when it comes to intelligence, and with the fact that they do have the upper hand with their air force and so on, and their many radars and their intelligence units and their drones. But Hezbollah is also telling the Israelis that they can also deal a very heavy blow on the intelligence in that regard as well. And so therefore, this in itself is very significant, not only militarily, but also when it comes to the intelligence factor.
Calls for an end to the genocide in Gaza have once again rung out in a number of cities around the world. People in the Jordanian capital have hit to the streets to voice their support for Palestinians. More than 2,000 demonstrators gathered near the Israeli embassy in Amman to condemn the regime's atrocities against Palestinians, but Jordanian police clamped down on the rally, firing tear gas on the protesters and detaining some of them. There were fresh pro-Palestinian rallies in several Iranian cities as well. Protesters in the capital, Tehran, gathered in front of the British embassy to vent their anger at the ongoing genocidal war in Gaza. The protesters chanted slogans against Israel, Britain, and the U.S. Several other locations in Tehran were the scenes of rallies in support of Gazans as well. Some other Iranian cities, including Mashhad, Tabriz, and other cities as well witnessed anti-Israeli demonstrations. Moving on, Russia is still reeling from Friday's terrorist attack on a concert hall near the capital, Moscow, that left scores of people dead and scores more wounded. Four main suspects have been charged with acts of terrorism and many face life in prison. A court statement said two of the detainees have already pleaded guilty. One of them, according to the Russian media, said that he is a citizen of Tajikistan. All have been remanded to pre-trial custody until May 22. Authorities addressed the men as they were attempting to escape to Ukraine. President Vladimir Putin has pledged to bring the perpetrators to book. Earlier, Kiev rejected the notion that it was involved in the incident that took place at a crowded Gorky City Hall. The attackers also set the venue ablaze that caused the roof of the hall to collapse. Russian authorities have confirmed 137 deaths and more than 180 injuries as a result of this attack.
Russian President Vladimir Putin addressed the nation after the deadly attack in Moscow, which killed dozens of civilians. The president denounced the massacre as a bloody and barbaric terrorist attack, as he declared March 24, a National Day of Mourning. At least 11 suspects, including four perpetrators who directly participated in the shooting spree, have been arrested. The four direct perpetrators were detained in Bryansk region. According to the intelligence service, the terrorists planned to cross the Russian-Ukrainian border. The Russian president vowed to punish all involved in the massacre.
All the perpetrators, organizers, and customers of this crime will suffer fair and inevitable punishment, whoever they are, whoever guides them. I repeat, we will identify and punish everyone who stands behind the terrorists, who prepared this atrocity, this attack on Russia, on our people.
The Daesh Takfiri terror group claimed responsibility, but Moscow has dismissed the claim, asserting that investigation is still underway to ascertain the main culprits. Russia's security service says the Moscow attackers had contacts in Ukraine supporting them. During interrogation, a detained terrorist said he was promised 5,000 rubles to carry out the terrorist attack. He claimed he watched a certain preacher on Telegram and allegedly his assistant contacted the man. The attack, which came amid Ukraine's war with Russia, was the deadliest in the country since the Beslan school siege in 2004. After Friday's attack, Putin held discussion with his Belarusian counterpart Alexander Lukashenko. Both leaders confirmed their readiness to work together in the fight against terrorism. In his address, President Putin said Moscow attackers were preparing to flee towards Ukraine, where a window had been prepared for them with the help of Ukraine. Now it remains to be seen how Russia is going to react to the massacre, which came in a very volatile region and amid its war against Ukraine. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
When the whole world is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrors fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need, which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that Thou willest, and givest me mercy from Thee. Forgiveness decreases Thee not, and giving injuries Thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from Thee: the facility to obey Thee at its beginning, and the favor of Thy forgiveness at its end. O He who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
Ayahs, 30 days. A monotheist person not only reflects on the noble Quran, but also tries to explain the ayahs of this heavenly scripture to others and make them familiar with its teachings. Explicating of the Quranic teachings, first of all, was the duty of the Prophet and his infallible successors, peace be upon them. Every faithful person, too, according to the extent that they had learnt from the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them, embarked on this heavy duty. So the ulama, or Muslim scholars, took over this duty after the occultation of the 12th infallible successor of the Holy Prophet, Imam Mahdi, may God hasten his reappearance, and have seriously continued this job until present day. Today, this duty has become even more important because of the broad assault of the enemies upon our beliefs of Islam and humanity. The topic of the 14th episode of the Ramadan special series is explicating and clarifying the realities. Thus, we're going to focus on Ayah 89 of Surah Al-Nahl in the Holy Quran. Please stay with us. The blessed month of Ramadan is a good opportunity to have a deep look at the Holy Quran to realize its messages and instructions. The Almighty introduces his book in part of Ayah 89 of Surah Al-Nahl as follows. We have sent down the book to you as a clarification of all things and as a guidance and mercy and good news for the Muslims. The word Muslim here has a general sense and means anyone who submits to God, his apostle and his religion. God also says in part of Ayah 44 of this surah, we sent down the remainder to you so that you may clarify for the people that which has been sent down to them, so that they may reflect. That's why Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, struggled in the way of Allah for 23 years to cause the sapling of Islam to root up in the hearts of the faithful and make the likelihood of returning to polytheism a minimum. Therefore, the Holy Prophet succeeded in clarifying to keep Islam out of crisis and seditions. Clarification means explicating and explaining the realities to find a way to go out of darkness and ambiguity. Once the social climate is obfuscated, many people cannot see the right way forward and go astray. Therefore, clarification is a torch in the darkness. For instance, after the defeat of Muslims in the Battle of Uhud, the Almighty did an important clarification and encountered the sedition of the hypocrites. While some intended to put the blame on the Prophet for the defeat and the death of a number of Muslims, God sent down Ayah 152 of Surah Ali Imran. And Allah certainly fulfilled His promise to you when you were slaying them with His leave, until you lost courage, disputed about the matter, and disobeyed, after He showed you what you loved. Some of you desire this world, and some of you desire the hereafter. Then He turned you away from them so that He might test you. And certainly He has excused you, for Allah is gracious to the faithful. Clarification of realities is feasible only through Islamic ethics and God-wariness. It means considering Allah present everywhere in every moment. Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him, recommends in his testament to his children and in fact to every faithful to struggle in the way of Allah. Imam Ali says, consider Allah in jihad with your properties, souls and tongues in the way of Allah. Jihad with souls means participation in the battlefield to safeguard Islam and Islamic countries against enemies. Jihad with properties means financial aid for the troops of Islam. Today, this includes every aid in cultural, social, and economic spheres for the benefit of Muslims. Jihad with tongue means logical defense and continuous propagation and promotion of Islam, which presently can be done through the media. Be careful. Jihad, in the sense of effort, struggle, and activity, is a general law in the universe, because all living creatures, including plants and animals, remove barriers through such kind of jihad to continue their lives. Every creature has pests and enemies that it cannot live or make progress unless it fights those pests and enemies. Roots of plants keep moving in the depth of ground to get food and water, so when they face a stone or any other obstacle, they either break into pieces or go round it and advance. Sometimes these fine roots act as firm drills. A look at our body too shows that the cells that are in struggle incessantly as microorganisms keep attacking through water, air and food and so on. If the defensive force of the human body does not fight them with white blood cells, we may be infected with a variety of diseases every day. This invisible and broad fight or jihad keeps us healthy. This is true in a society as well. A society which gives up relentless effort to keep its status will perish or become weak and base very soon. Certainly, verbal and logical jihad is one of the scenes that, if it is given up, it will lead to further pressures on the enemies. During his short rule, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him, was often in conflict with Muawiyah, the rebel. Some unaware people would compare him with Muawiyah, saying, "Muawiyah is a clever politician." This word can be heard even today. But Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him, answered them by saying, "By God, Muawiyah is not cleverer than me, but he tricks and commits sin. His politics is unconditioned, and he considers every vice permitted to advance his political purposes." Today, too, there are people who resort to any evil act to achieve their nasty and illegitimate goals. They chant beautiful slogans like human rights, freedom, and women's rights, and so on, to conceal their real evil intentions.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson. This is Palestine Declassified. We're the only weekly show that's dedicated to investigating and exposing the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. After Michael Gove, the UK's Secretary of State for Levelling Up, announced the government's redefinition of extremism, we'll be examining the implications of his statement in this week's show. It seems Mr. Gove is attempting to invoke the divide-and-rule tactics of the former British Empire to weaken the pro-Palestine movement that's been sweeping the country since October the 7th. As Latifa Abu Chakra will explain in this report.
The British government has been grappling with the question of extremism for years now. It has failed even to define extremism in any clear fashion, and has been struggling to fight back against an avalanche of criticism that its counter-extremism policies are Islamophobic. The genocide in Gaza has focused minds in the British elite because of the massive sympathy for the Palestinians visible on the streets. The desperate attempt to cast pro-Palestine protesters as genocidal is a desperate attempt to split the movement. The government is trying to reframe extremism in such a way that more radical supporters of Palestinian liberation are demonized, criminalized, and disavowed by the rest of the movement. The minister leading this is the toxic Michael Gove, the most pro-Zionist minister in the government. He has a history of involvement with Zionist lobby groups and, for example, was the first chairman of the neoconservative and Islamophobic think tank Policy Exchange. It's no coincidence that the new policy he is introducing was dreamt up by the Policy Exchange in a paper published in 2022. All of its main proposals were adopted by Lord William Shawcross in his review of Prevent, published in 2023. Shawcross is famously Islamophobic and was appointed as a senior fellow at the Policy Exchange in 2018, prior to being appointed to the Prevent review in 2021. Shawcross's recommendations were all accepted by the government, and thus the new policy has effectively been written by a leading Islamophobic think tank. Among the innovations are a new blacklisting agency in Gove's department and a change in the status of the Commission for Countering Extremism, which changes from being an advisory to an enforcement agency. But behind Policy Exchange are a shadowy group of foundations which provide cash for its work. Though they are secretive, we can reveal at least two. The first and most significant is the Charles Wolfson Charitable Trust, which donates almost every year and has given Policy Exchange more than £3 million between 2007 and 2022. The Wolfson family, which runs the trust, are the owners of the Next retail chain. The Wolfson family also funds Beit Lochem, which channels money to the occupation forces, and the Jerusalem Foundation, which is engaged in promoting illegal settlements in occupied East Jerusalem. Another source of funds is the Rosencrantz Foundation, which has given to the think tank for more than a decade, along with other Islamophobic causes. Its director, Robert Rosencrantz, was appointed a director of Policy Exchange in 2010. In other words, British government policy on extremism is captured by Policy Exchange, and Policy Exchange is in part a front for Zionist interests.
Joining me in the studio, as usual, is our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and a former professor at Bristol University, and is now a non-resident senior research fellow at the Centre for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul Zeyim University. He's also a co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch, and is a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. Our guest contributor today is Dr. Eital Hajj. Dr. Leila is the director and senior caseworker at Prevent Watch, which is a community-led initiative that supports individuals affected by the Prevent programme. She's written extensively on Prevent and co-authored the People's Review of Prevent, which was an alternative to the widely boycotted official review of the Prevent policy. Welcome to the show. David, the Policy Exchange, they must be absolutely delighted, wouldn't they, with Michael Gove's statement. I mean, could have been written by them. I mean, what do you make of that think tank?
Well, I mean, more or less was written by them. I mean, Policy Exchange is the first think tank that I think I ever looked at back in the late noughties. And we looked at the way in which it was encouraging Islamophobia, and that was why we'd looked at it. And we discovered, one of the things we discovered was that amongst the people who funded it were these foundations, and the foundations were all named after individuals, and we tried to work out what they were, and it transpired that, you know, amongst the other things that they funded were these Israeli occupation forces, settlements in the West Bank, and we realised that what we were dealing with here was Zionist foundations. So it was Zionist foundations who were largely funding the Policy Exchange and other neocon think tanks, and that's what we have here. We have effectively Zionist interests using a think tank to talk to government, and then their views are then taken on by government, by people who are appointed by government who come from the think tank itself, and then those views themselves are passed on to the minister, who himself was a first chair of Policy Exchange. It's a completely self-referential and closed circle.
Well, Dr. Lehrer, I mean, what's your view then of the 2022 Policy Exchange report?
So that report was called Delegitimizing Counterterrorism, and it essentially attacked every single Muslim organization or individual who had A, boycotted the Shawcross Review of Prevent, and B, who had signed up and endorsed and supported the People's Review of Prevent. It was essentially a way to divide the Muslim organisations from the non-Muslim organisations and individuals, because if you look at who boycotted the Shawcross report, it extended way beyond any of the Muslim organisations that had been highlighted in that report. But it also tried to then divide Muslim organisations against one another as well, because following that report, there was a tabloid splash of like four organisations that, you know, are seen as the main Islamist agitators. So it kind of further then subdivided some organisations from the main list. Sure. It didn't look at any of the non-Muslim organisations. It didn't look at the fact that the People's Review of Prevent had the foreword from the UN Special Rapporteur for protecting freedoms while countering terrorism. It didn't look at the fact that Professor Conor Gearty had written the second foreword. It didn't look at any of the NGOs, the mainstream NGOs, Amnesty's, the Runnymedes, who had also supported that report. So I think it was just a way to plagiarise the People's Review of Prevent, because 90% of that report from Policy Exchange just spoke about our report without actually tackling any of the issues, whilst just trying to smear these organisations. And the former Prime Minister, David Cameron, wrote a foreword to the Policy Exchange report saying that these people who are basically raising concerns about Prevent are enablers of terrorism.
Well, of course, Lord Shawcross, David, was in charge of the Charity Commission, wasn't he? I mean, you say a word or two, will you, about his role there, will you?
So he was appointed to the Charity Commission, and he appointed a number of other people to the Charity Commission who were, like him, Islamophobes and had connections to Islamophobic organisations. And his role at the Charity Commission was to take on Muslim charities and to investigate them. Now, quite often, those Muslim charities were investigated after allegations were made about those charities, which had emanated from Israel, unsurprisingly. And so you had an attack on a whole series of Muslim charities, actually, and, of course, not really virtually no Zionist charities, for example, were targeted. And what it's meant is that the whole Muslim charity sector lives in fear of the Charity Commission. And and to try and be in a charity and be a Muslim and to have a Muslim charity is really very difficult now because of this British state onslaught on the Muslim charity sector. And, of course, then Shawcross goes on after that to be appointed to the Policy Exchange and then to be appointed by government to do the review of Prevent. So he's, you know, he's not in a position to do any significant serious review because, of course, he is party pre. He's all fundamentally conflicted.
Well, as I mentioned in the introduction there, Dr. Lehrer, I mean, you were part of that, you know, People's review of Prevent, which actually engaged, didn't it, in a debate with the review of extremism that was conducted by Lord Shawcross. Just tell us a little bit, really, about what you found during that process.
Yeah, so the People's Review of Prevent was set up as an alternative to the Shawcross Review because once he was appointed and boycotted, we knew he wasn't going to take on any of the real issues and concerns that had been raised for well over a decade, nor was he going to look at people who had actually been impacted, referred to Prevent, etc. So the People's Review of Prevent took into consideration almost 600 cases of people who had actually been referred to Prevent, as well as all of the academic research that had come out previously on Prevent. And at the end of that, our three main conclusions was that Prevent doesn't actually work. It's not fit for purpose. It doesn't prevent terrorism. There's been zero evidence to suggest that. And in fact, all the evidence suggests that it actively doesn't work, especially when you look at convicted terrorists who have been known to prevent prior. You know, they weren't caught by Prevent to stop and therefore prevent terrorism. The second main conclusion was that it causes harm, particularly to Muslim families and children, traumatizing them. And the third main conclusion was that it is curtailing so many human rights, from freedom of expression to data privacy and data rights. So those were the three main conclusions, and none of those conclusions were picked up by government or engaged with at any point, not that we expected them to be, other than that Policy Exchange report that was then subsequently published about a month or so after.
David, we've mentioned the Wolfson family on this show on a number of previous occasions, haven't we? And I see that they are implicated in this process too, aren't they? So I wonder whether you could just outline what exactly then is their involvement in this particular issue.
So the Wilson family have been making money in this country for decades and decades through the Great Universal Stores and now most recently through Next PLC. And they've made a reputation for philanthropy. So they have a number of different foundations associated with the family. There are four or five different foundations. They give large sums of money to Wilson College, Oxford, Wilson College, Cambridge, and many other charitable donations. But of course, also, they give significant sums of money to Zionist projects, so to settlements in the West Bank, and particularly they fund the Jerusalem Foundation, which is engaged in illegal activities in East Jerusalem. And they also fund, and indeed the chair of this charity, Beit Halochim, is an organisation which gives money directly to the Israel occupation forces. Mm-hmm. So there's a real sense there in which they're involved directly in supporting the Zionist project and the genocide in Gaza. But also, of course, they're involved in supporting Islamophobic activities through the policy exchange. And Andrew Wilson, for example, or Simon Wilson are involved with that. And as a result, what you have is that you can see that the Zionists are actually core to developing and pushing Islamophobic ideas in the UK and in other countries too. And that's a thing I've been seeing for many years now. It's one of the things which attracted attention to my views when I was at the University of Bristol. But it's very clear that there's a connection between the Zionists and the pushing of Islamophobia, and you can see it through this particular connection between the Wilson family and the cash they give to the policy exchange.
Michael Gove was the first chair, wasn't he, of the policy exchange? And as I was saying to David earlier, I mean, this report or this statement could have been written by them. I mean, what's your thoughts on that briefly before we go to our next report?
I mean, Michael Gove has been problematic for many reasons, not just the policy exchange link. I mean, he was at the centre of the Trojan Horse affair, effectively ruining education in the UK, and many other Islamophobic as well as anti-Palestinian sentiments have come from him. But I mean, his involvement in this, as well as policy exchange's involvement in the new so-called definition of extremism, is to be expected. Yeah. I don't think we can imagine anyone else who would have taken the reins on this, nor anybody who wanted to. I mean, the Independent Review of Terrorism doesn't have Prevent under his purview, nor extremism. Sure. You know, Sarah Khan, when she was appointed as head of CCE, everyone thought she was going to come out with a definition of extremism, and she didn't. Mm. Robin Simcox, who then took over CCE, didn't.
So it's significant then that it's Michael Gove. But it's important, I think, that we shine a light on his role, and you know, I think that will undermine his credibility still further, hopefully. But we'll just take a pause there now to our next report about the naked abuse of parliamentary privilege to stem the tidal wave of support for Palestine from the British people.
Let me just ask, in the interest of balance, is there anyone here who welcomes what Michael Gove had to say and supports what he had to say? Not a hand up, okay.
The British government is in a bind. It can't define extremism, and yet it wants to pretend that it can. It claims that its new policy contains a, quote, new definition of extremism. But there was never an old definition, and the text they have published is not a definition either. There is still no legal definition of extremism, and this is why the government are at pains to point out that this definition is not statutory and has no effect on the existing criminal law. The reason for this is that the government knows that if they try and create a statutory definition, it will be subject to legal challenge, which it will most probably lose. There's a nervousness about this, which is intriguing. First of all, Michael Gove named five extremist organizations under parliamentary privilege because he knows he would be subject to legal action were he to name them outside the House. Secondly, though the aim here is to destroy and disrupt the Palestine Solidarity Movement, no primarily Palestine-related groups were named. But pro-Palestine groups, Friends of Al-Aqsa, was named in drafts of the speech leaked to the media. The government were too nervous even to name them in Parliament. Gove stated in the Commons that Islamism is a totalitarian ideology which calls for the establishment of an Islamic state governed by Sharia law. He named three groups, the Muslim Association of Britain, CAGE and MEND, all perfectly legal organisations. Mend immediately challenged Gove to, quote, repeat his claims outside of Parliament and without the protection of parliamentary privilege. To provide the evidence that Mend has called for the establishment of an Islamic state governed by Sharia law. Even normally staunch allies such as government advisor John Mann have criticized the policy. The division is between those pushing for a Likudnik scorched earth approach and those who favor a sophisticated engagement strategy. This is not just a political and strategic difference, but a question of defending the millions in state and Zionist funding plowed into the maintenance of hundreds of jobs in sophisticated engagement, such as the interfaith industry. Underlying all of this is the danger that the definition best fits genocidal Zionist groups and their supporters within government, most notably Michael Gove himself. The penetration and capture of key elements of security policy by the Zionist is nothing if it is not, as the new so-called definition puts it, an attempt to undermine, overturn, or replace the UK system of liberal parliamentary democracy and democratic rights in the service of attempting to negate or destroy the fundamental rights and freedoms of others, most obviously Muslims and Palestinians and their supporters.
Dr. Layla, I mean, some people are suggesting that this is just an attempt to proscribe organisations by the back door. What do you think about that?
Absolutely agree with that, because if you look at from a legal perspective, there is nothing that these organisations are doing that is illegal that could be used in a way against them to shut them down. And this is one way, as they say, you know, this new definition of extremism, it's not statutory, but it doesn't mean that it won't have impact. This will have impact on the ground. Of course it will. If you look at charities, for example, who are trying to host events with these organisations, they may have to jump through extra hurdles via the Charity Commission in terms of, you know, if you're inviting an extremist speaker, and technically they will be on that list of extremist speakers without being able to, not being afforded to even challenge it legally because there is no legal basis. And this is exactly what we see with Prevent. You know, Prevent technically is voluntary. Doesn't mean that it hasn't caused harm to thousands of people across the UK.
I mean, we've already seen lots of people being cancelled. I mean, David and I are case in point, really. I guess this is just going to exacerbate that problem. But David, why do you think they're struggling so much then to define extremism then?
Well, because they start off with this idea that they're counteracting and countering terrorism. And, of course, that involves the commission of acts of violence, and which are, you know, identifiable as being against the law. And we have a burgeoning terrorism legislation on the statute books, and that's been expanding over the years since the first introduction of the Provincial Terrorism Act, temporary provisions, as it was called back in the 70s. And, of course, they've then moved to this idea of non-violent extremism, or of extremism which is of a sort which might not really be terrorism, but might be leading up to terrorism. But they can't really define that because, of course, these are actions which are not illegal, which are not violent, and which only arguably, in their own minds, have anything to do with the process of leading up to violence, the process of which they call radicalisation. Now, of course, we saw this in the case of the Irish conflict, where in the 1980s, Sinn Féin were banned from television.
Yeah.
So the idea of supporting an illegal organisation or an organisation named in this notice, Sinn Féin, was prescribed, but nobody could actually work out what supporting that organisation meant, and it was so ridiculous that the whole thing collapsed, partly as a result of the peace process too. So we'll find something similar here. If you have a definition, then when you try and work out what it actually means, it will just be absurd and will collapse. And that's why they've got this pretend definition, and also it's an attempt, as Dr. Layla has been saying, to intimidate. These are the reasons they can't define it.
Well, Dr. Layla, I mean, the earlier documents seem to suggest that Mr. Gove was considering naming a much wider group of organisations, including your own Prevent Watch and groups like Palestine Action and Friends of Al-Aqsa. I mean, what's going on here?
I mean, it's quite ridiculous. If you look at, for example, Prevent Watch, we are literally a helpline to support people who have had their rights abused. So we would never come under any definition, not that we would even respect any definition put forward for extremism in a way, because of the fact that the whole trajectory and the history of trying to define it has been nonsense,
indeed,
including this new one. But I do think it is just an attempt to intimidate and to place that idea that, you know, if you support these organisations, then there may be a problem. If you look at actually the shift from the old so-called definition of extremism to this new one, it's shifted from being very individual-based, so looking at individuals who might be extremist, to the infrastructure that supports the Muslim community. So we're now looking at institutions. And there was a report published a few years back, I can't remember which report it was, but the sole purpose of that report was to look at all of these organisations and look at their social media influence. And so if you look at some of the organisations that have made the list, those organisations have a huge impact when it comes to their social media reach. And it was by one of these right-wing think tanks, this report that was conducted, and I'm sure it has influenced, you know, how many organisations are being put up, whether they're officially named or whether it's like, yeah, oh, we might leak these organisations, oh no, we won't. No, I mean, they've already leaked it, the damage has been done potentially. Yeah.
Well, David, excuse me, David, what's your view of the three organisations, Muslim organisations, that that were named? You know, the Muslim Association of Britain, CAGE and MEND, I mean, mentioned in the report there. I mean, perfectly respectable organisations. Just say a bit, what's your view of those organisations?
Well, I mean, the Muslim Association of Britain is an interesting organisation. It's said by Gove to be the British affiliate of the Muslim Brotherhood. Supposed to put scary quotes around it. But the Muslim Association of Britain, of course, was one of the three organisations which set up the Stop the War Coalition after the invasion, in the run-up to and after the invasion of Iraq, and was core to the success of the anti-war movement, which had 2 million people on the streets in 2003. And of course, the reason it was core to it was because it was a Muslim organisation, and that was the essential success. And that is what scared the horses in Whitehall. Muslims are getting politically active. And you see the same thing with the almost inclusion of Friends of Al-Aqsa. Friends of Al-Aqsa, of course, one of the key organisers of the massive pro-Palestine demonstrations have been since October the 7th, along with Palestine Solidarity, to stop the war. So again, this is an attempt to take out part of the key coalition which brings together this massive wave of support for Palestine and against British foreign policy, complicity and direct engagement of the British in the genocide. So that's one thing, right? And the second thing is, of course, the other organisations. CAGE is a human rights organisation. Dr. Lely used to work there. And I've written on a number of occasions about CAGE should not be attacked. They're a human rights organisation, and it's absurd to accuse them of extremism. And then MEND, I mean, MEND are milder than CAGE are. It's completely absurd to say. Yeah. I mean, the idea that MEND is an organisation which calls for a caliphate, which would itself, in my view, be completely fine, because the caliphate is not any particular thing. It's a system of government in which Muslim ideas might be reflected, just like Christian ideas are reflected or Hindu ideas are reflected in some other systems of government. So this is a nonsense from start to finish. And of course, the reason why they can't name these organisations outside is because they're going to be taken to court and they're going to lose.
Indeed. Well, just briefly then, because we're almost out of time, Dr. Layla, what should we then make of Mr. Gove's new policy? Briefly.
I think absolutely nothing of it, other than another dog whistle politics attempt to intimidate people, not only to not support individuals who might have ideas that are very conservatively Muslim, but also to try and attack the infrastructure that helps these Muslim to participate in public life.
Indeed. And probably we should be ridiculing it whenever we get the opportunity. It is so absurd, isn't it? But thank you to our guest, Dr. Layla Aital Hajj, and our resident expert, Professor David Miller. So until next time, when Palestine Declassified will be back with more forensic investigations and analysis, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
With the presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. This is IRIB English Radio's Viewpoints. I am Hadi Saravi, your host. In the journey of our everyday life, we humans are faced with different tasks to revalue and reshape ourselves. Sometimes we do great and sometimes we don't. Sometimes we fail and there are times we succeed. And by doing so, we move on to the next stage. but some special days and months which are of utmost value, days that are all gain and progress, days that are so unique that even every breath counts, if and if you truly do your best to stay on the path to please the mighty Allah. On today's episode, we're going to talk about Ramadan al-Karim and some issues relating to its precious moments. Here in the studio, I'm, like always, accompanied by Brother Ali. Welcome to the show.
Assalamu alaikum. Thank you very much. And it's a great pleasure to be here.
This is great to have you here. And also, on my right, I have Dr. Rouhani. Thank you for being here.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
This is great to see you again.
Thank you very much. You're welcome.
Okay, so, with this introduction, you may know that we're going to talk about Ramadan. And it's a very precious time. Let's talk about the things, the dynamics of these times. What happens, how people change, and what the effects of Ramadan on people's behavior, types of connections, and socializing.
Well, good question, because Ramadan is known, in the words of the Holy Prophet of Islam, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, is known as the huwa shahrul mawasat. That is, it is the month of accompanying those who are in torture, in trouble. Mm-hmm. Yep. So this is, I think, a social clue that gives us that in the month of Ramadan we can sense the difficulties, the thirst and the hunger of those who are thirsty and hungry.
Mm.
From the other side, since we see that in these days, based on the recommendations and based on narrations from the Holy Prophet and his infallible successes, we have received lots of recommendations just to invite others for some meals of iftar or sahar or suhoor or in a downtime. So people are trying to compete in this area, and mm-hmm. this is good that people mm-hmm. We lend to meeting each other more and visiting each other more,
and also people socialize on the topic. Talk about the food.
At the same time, in the daytime, they felt and experienced the thirst and hunger of those who are poor and those in a state of poverty. In the nighttime, they are actually meeting each other, and maybe they are thinking about how to, for example, compensate for those who have, for example, yet met or in the daytime, or they have actually understood their problems. Mm-hmm. You see, so and again, in with a good tradition of